The Economic Development Budget Division for Monday, February 18th, will come to order. Senator Coring, you're the only author here, so you go ahead and start your presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I've tried to turn over a new leaf this year and show up on time at committee meetings.
What was that line we heard that being on time is a... I'll think of it. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chairman, I was told that we have a lot of requests, and the people that are first in line will get their requests answered. That's why I'm here first. Well, first of all, I want to thank the chairman and the committee.
I like the editorializing there on that.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you, and I want to thank the committee for giving us the chance to have this heard. And I want to thank John Schley, who's the chairman of the Garrison Catheo board, and Ted, how do you pronounce your name?
Kostechka,
and Herb Scattarelli. And Barb Brandt and Barb Welty, who's not here today. I want to thank them for driving all the way down to talk about this important issue. What we're talking about, Mr. Chairman and committee, we're asking for a $2 million appropriation from bond proceeds for the wastewater connection. What it is the Native Americans built a wastewater treatment plant just north of the casino in Mille Lacs County, and what we're trying to do is hook up all the folks from, and the chairman can tell me if I'm wrong on this, we're trying to hook up everybody from the casino all the way up to the city of Garrison, taking literally hundreds and hundreds of individual septic sewers offline and putting them all, hooking them all up to the wastewater treatment plant. You know, we talk about water quality and clean water and things of that nature around here. Here's our opportunity to take care of that, where we'd have literally hundreds of individual sewers offline. It's going to increase the quality of Lake Mille Lacs. It's just going to be a win-win situation. This project is already underway. We're asking for $2 million to help keep the project up and going. I did ask the board here if they're ready to use this $2 million. If they received it, they said we're ready to go right now. So I would turn it over to the chairman, John Schley, to give a little bit of a presentation on this, and then we'd be glad to answer any questions. And if we could have, if there's a page here, we do have a handout for the committee. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schley. Please state your name for the record.
That's it. John Schley, S-C-H-L-E-Y, chairman of the board of managers of the Garrison Catheo West Mille Lacs Sanitary District.
Are you the mayor also?
Yes, of the city of Garrison, yes.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
And thank you for allowing us time to testify, and to Paul for arranging it. We are partially done with the project, and of course we want to get the project done as fast as possible, get things online. Our district includes parts of Catheo Township, Garrison Township, and a total of the city of Garrison. And it crosses two counties, Crow Wing County and Mille Lacs County. So it's an extensive project. It's probably about 10 miles long from the north to the south end of it. And we are taking in parts, the most populated parts of Smith and Holt Lake, to protect those because they flow into Mille Lacs, and a portion of Borden Lake, and of course all the city of Garrison and along the entire west shore of Mille Lacs Lake, up from Garrison south to Wigwam Bay. So we did get some federal grant money, and we also thank the state of Minnesota for the $4 million in grant we got several years ago. We were able to, with that money, complete phase one and phase 2A and 2B. And now we have some more money, federal but not enough, to go into phase three, which will be of five different segments, quite extensive. So the contract has been okayed for all of phase three, the five segments. We only have money enough to do two of them at this point, or three. So therefore, there's two segments that would have to wait for more funding. But should we get this funding, we can kick that in right away, because the contract has been let by segments, and I'm sure that Archon will want to finish the job, and so therefore the $2 million would be utilized this year and part of next.
Mayor, do you know where you are on the list of the PFA from the Public Facilities Authority? Senator Corrigan, do you know that maybe?
I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kuhlman here by any chance? He's not here. Okay, anyway.
Let me see all those on it.
So this $2 million would get you to phase three, get phase three done?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Any questions of the committee? Oh, you wanted to hand those out?
There's the handout.
Coleman, do you have a list? Are they on there?
It's a big one.
Okay. Any questions of the committee?
Does that mean that it's a done deal then, or
it's done for today?
For me, Senator.
No, we have to.
Are we taking votes, Mr. Chairman?
Huh?
Are we taking votes, Mr. Chairman?
No. All of these wastewater things are going through the Public Facilities Authority. They all get a scoring, and I think they're going to be going down to a scoring of 45 points. And I'm not exactly sure what 45 points means, but we've got a list of them, and. We need about $100 million to do all the projects, and it would be the right thing to do to put $100 million into the Public Facilities Authority to get all the projects done. But I don't think the governor's recommending that much, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get that
much. Did you start the printing press in the basement?
Huh?
Did you start the printing press in the basement already?
All of these projects need to be done eventually, and we actually need to put the money in. But $100 million into the Public Facilities Authority would generate a whole bunch of match money from the federal government, and we'd get a real lot of these wastewater treatment projects done that need to get done, because they don't get any cheaper as we wait a little bit longer. So,
and Mr. Chairman, if I could just take a couple more minutes, if you'd tell them what the project cost was initially and now what it is now and how much federal money you got.
Okay, in the year 2000 or thereabouts, we had an estimate of this project cost of $17.5 million.
Ooh.
According to the figures I've used here, there's some extra figures on this sheet that was given to me by the Corps of Engineers. The project cost is about $23,661,000 now, because it's went up so dramatically in that time. We did so far get $5,591,000 plus $957,000 additional from the federal government, of which we have to match 25%. And this is where some help from the state of Minnesota again can help us. Okay. Also, from rural development, we did get a $2 million grant from them and a $2 million loan. That we used with the $4 million from the state to complete phase two of this project.
Okay.
So hopefully you can understand what I've penciled in here.
Okay, we got it. So, okay, thank you. And Senator Corrigan, the line I was trying to think of is punctuality is the theft of time, but
yes.
In your case.
And Mr. Chairman, I think we scored this at 45, so is that what it needed to be at? Or?
Well, I'm not the score marker. You know, I'd probably give you 100, you know. But.
Mr. Kuhlman.
Thank you, committee, for
all right.
Its time.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you very much.
Who wants to go next? Senator Pogemiller or Senator Stump? Who wants to go next?
Thank you.
Is Mike doing it, I hope?
Welcome, Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This is the Southeast Minneapolis Industrial University Research Park, SEMI. I think we're on about 5 or 6 years now that we've been working with the state. In about 98, there was a local match with some deed redevelopment grants. In 2006, there was about $1 million of local funds to match bioscience infrastructure grants. And now we have a request for $6.85 million to accelerate this development of municipal infrastructure around the bioscience subzone that the University of Minnesota is creating. This area is basically east and of the stadium that's being developed with the research buildings, and it abuts the city of St. Paul. So it's kind of that industrial area from the stadium back towards St. Paul. And the infrastructure and stormwater activity here is for something called Granary Road, which will be a important road through this area to allow for the movement of people and goods related to all the development in this area. I want to turn it over to Mike Christensen, who's the development director for the city of Minneapolis. And again, this is a continuation of a partnership with the state over a 5 or 6 year period. And it's starting to ramp up. There'll be another phase in 2010, and then a third phase in 2012. And all of this activity will be done in conjunction with whatever's done on the Central Corridor and whatever the city of St. Paul is doing on some of their activities. I don't know if one of their discussions today is related to the adjacent property in St. Paul. It's next to St. Paul, and they're very interested in this area of development also. And I support every project that the mayor of St. Paul is here for today.
That would be how many?
Senator Pogemiller, thank you for the kind introduction. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Senator Pogemiller and Senator Dibble will tell you, Minneapolis is a healthcare town increasingly.
Just say your name for the record, please.
Mike Christensen. I'm the director of the Department of Community Planning and Economic Development for the city of Minneapolis. The city of Minneapolis is increasingly a healthcare town. About 17% of our residents work in healthcare and related industries. You may have noticed we have been blessed with the expansions of healthcare and campuses now throughout the city. Allina Health System is in Midtown Exchange. A $125 million heart hospital has been erected by Abbott Northwestern. Children's Hospital has announced a major expansion along Chicago Avenue. Hennepin County Medical Center is planning a major expansion. Fairview University has now cleared the city process for a $200 million expansion on Riverside. We are increasingly a healthcare town. We've gathered 4,200 additional jobs off these campuses in the last 4 years. There is one sector of the healthcare economy which we have not captured, and that is the new therapies, stem cell and otherwise, that are being used to fight disease and injury. And increasingly, this group has heard from the University of Minnesota and its bioscience proposal. There are jobs that will be leveraged off those four bioscience buildings. We expect those bioscience buildings to actually employ about 600 university employees, 120 of which are PhD and above researchers. They will begin to seed commercial development, and we hope that commercial development is right next to the university. In the area that Senator Pogemiller described and is fully described in the maps in your packets. Granary Road is a $6.85 million bonding request. It is a road. It's a road designed to dissect that formerly industrial area. It will serve new commercial sites and we believe result in about three times the amount of jobs the university will create in those four bioscience buildings, about 1,800 jobs will directly result from this road. So you say, why is a road so important through a former industrial area? Well, look at North 2nd Street. You may know North 2nd Street as the road that is now in front of McPhail Center for the Arts, the Guthrie, the Gold Medal Park, and all that riverfront development. just on the south side of the river in Minneapolis. In the 1980s, North 2nd Street had a locomotive on it. It was not a road. It was not paved. It was a rail track. And now, today, of course, it serves all of those institutions and parks, Gold Medal Park, Guthrie, McPhail Center for the Arts, the Depot, all are well served by one road. That is the importance of a road in my world, in the development world. What has that meant in terms of tax base in that area of the city? In 1994, the tax base of that riverfront area was $34 million. Today, it's $334 million, and that's a conservative estimate. So we will see economic growth from infrastructure. We have seen it in other parts of the city. We think this part of the city is even better suited because of its proximity to the university and the very important economic opportunities that have been described to this committee so well by the university and university leadership. I'm joined today by some advocates for this proposal. I've been meeting with Dr. Frank Serra, the Academic Health Center, and Dale Wallstrom, the leader of the Biobusiness Alliance in the state of Minnesota, for over a year to understand better how this road and other infrastructure will help develop further the vision that's been brought to you by President Brunix. Today, joining us from the university are Jay Schrankler of the Office of Technology Commercialization, Mary Capel, an Assistant VP for Public Affairs, and Marty McDonough, an Assistant VP with University Relations. I'll also note for the committee, Mr. Chair, that from the business community, we have Michael McLaughlin, who's the Executive Director of the Southeast Business Association, and Carl Robertson, the Chair of the Southeast Economic Development Committee, a 20-year-old committee, and the owner of ShoQuest Architects in that immediate area. We're also joined today by the Chair of the City Council's Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Betsy Hodges, and I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to summarize, key is there's a lot of different public and private entities working on development of this 500 acres, and there are significant contamination issues, reuse issues, and so forth. The city's part of this is to use its own money plus money it can accumulate in other fashions to make sure that the public infrastructure of stormwater and transportation are available for this development that's going on. So this is jobs.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe staff can answer this. Is it customary for the to do bonding for specific roads related to economic development? Has that been the practice?
Mr. Chairman, generally it's not directly on the road itself. It's for the area, and the local match does the road, and then the state money would do the other infrastructure cost, like the light rail, perhaps some housing. We generally do not use state general obligation bonds on roads that might be trunk highway roads or later on turned over to the state or transportation.
Thank you.
Senator Parisot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions of either Mr. Christensen or Senator Pogemiller. How much road are you getting on Granary Road? I see it on the large, most colorful map, that the red is the first request, and then you've got the future in pink. Is that correct?
Correct.
How much will you be getting? And this red part that shows the private sector research park, is that one unit or one entity that has a contract with some of the would get university kinds of money and NIS and some of those kinds of contracts to do research, or are these going to be small individual operations in there?
Mr. Christensen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Parisot, 1 mile is the answer to the question of what we seek the bonding monies for, and as Senator Pogemiller stated, those bonding monies would be leveraged with local funds and, of course, MSA funds in the area. We have a total plan that's before you in your packet. No one landholder in the area holds all the land. The public in the city of Minneapolis increasingly owns less, not more land, and our development policy is to ensure that More and more public lands are actually brought into private hands. John Wall and his father, Fred, who owns a Highland Bank, own 12 acres, and we work closely with them, as well as other property owners in the immediate area. We know of three opportunity sites in particular that we think will be future corporate sites.
So are these research parks going to be, Mr. Chairman, corporate-type research things, or might they be medical related to maybe university connections and other kinds of connections?
Mr. Christensen?
Mr. Chair, committee members, it most certainly would be corporate and lab space, primarily of the type that you see in the area right now. The university actually has three lab buildings over there, including the MRI building, the magnetic resonance building, the Dr. Bill McQuire Translational Research Facility. They will look like, and the new bioscience building, which is now on the ground. So they will look like those buildings.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just responding. I was just going to respond to Mr. Jensen's earlier comments. He's correct that we don't use GO bonds for parts of the state highway system. We're prohibited from doing so, but I don't think I heard anyone say that these roads are going to become a part of the state highway system. We do use GO bonds as a match for local roads, and in fact, the governor's proposal in his bonding bill has quite a bit of that. We're likewise doing the same in the transportation finance bill. So this would be an appropriate use for GO bonds for to match local roads.
Thank you. Do you like to add something, Mr. Christensen?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions of the committee? If not, thank you, Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Pogemiller.
Yeah, sorry.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Our Senate file 2768 is a proposal to request some funding for it's a result of the flood damage reduction protection that is going on in Crookston, Minnesota. And what's happening, and I was just want to refer you to one of the handouts in there, and it's a colored sheet, and that will give you a good explanation of kind of the location. And on the front of it, it says Crookston Flood Control Project Ice Arena Replacement. The community has come very close to being flooded a number of times, and as the you remember back in 97 when East Grand Forks flooded, Crookston also sustained a significant amount of flooding. There's if you looked at Crookston from a bird's eye view, the river kind of winds around, as you can see here, through town, and there's a number of areas in Crookston that needed to have dikes in order to protect it from being flooded. One of those areas is the what's in the picture below, picture on that front page. And you see the red line that goes around that little peninsula. That is where the dike needs to go for protection for the businesses and the homes in that area. The only problem is that it, right on the left side, you can see that facility, which is the Crookston's hockey or ice arena, or it's the community gathering place for not only the high school and the community, the young people that use it for skating and everything, but also the University of Minnesota, because they don't have hockey arena either. And so everybody uses it. The ice time is used very, very efficiently. But when that dike goes through to protect that part of Crookston, they have to demolish or remove that arena. And that's what really kind of what the request is to help with the demolition and and some of the restoration of that particular facility. We have the city manager here with us, and we can have him explain a little bit more. I do want to share one little story with you. That particular building, and I believe it was a WPA project, so that's a very, very old building. It goes back into the 30s. And some of the committee was there, and it's extremely, well, you can tell it's quite old. Well, during the Second World War, when the Allied troops captured a number of very high-ranking German officers, they did not want to put those officers in the same prisoner of war facilities as the ordinary soldiers that were captured. So they transported those officers, those German officers, to Crookston, Minnesota, and housed them in that facility as a dormitory. And then they would have, they would take them and they would go out and do work on farms during the daytime. But that's a very little known fact, but it came out when we were up there on the bonding tour. So maybe you
could. Welcome to the committee.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, Parrish, P-A-R-R-I-S-H, and I am the city administrator for the city of Crookston. And I guess I don't have a lot of additional comments to add to what Senator Stumpf has indicated, just to emphasize the fact that this truly is a flood mitigation project. The DNR has identified the city of Crookston as being one of the most flood-prone and most highest flood-risk communities in the state of Minnesota. And I know this gets a little bit complicated in terms of the discussion because of the arena component, and as we've talked about it locally, you know, this is an issue of flood protection in terms of the quality and level of protection that we can provide for the 162 homes and businesses that would be protected here. It wouldn't matter if it was a police station, a potato plant, or an ice arena. This is really a right-of-way acquisition that we need to complete in order to provide the most opportune flood protection for the community. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many sheets of ice is the current arena?
Chair, members of the committee, Senator Vanderveer, the current arena currently has two sheets of ice, one event facility, and one practice facility. As you'll note in the proposal, the replacement contemplates three sheets of ice. As Senator Stumpf indicated, these facilities are fairly old, and we actually, since the project has evolved, we've added a number of users, and so it is our perspective at this point in time that in order to best meet community needs, we would need to have a third sheet included. I can go on and talk to you about scheduling and things like that, but suffice it to say, we have an untenable situation, particularly in light of the fact that we attempt to support, albeit at this point inadequately, a university hockey program.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Vanderveer.
How many square feet is the current facility that you're replacing?
Mr. Parrish.
Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Vanderveer, the current facility is approximately 85,000 square feet.
And the new facility would be?
Chair, members of the committee, I guess at this point I don't have the estimated square footage for the proposed project. It's a conceptual design at this point, and so we don't have the estimated square footage.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Further questions of the witness or Senator Stumpf? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Cohn, we understand that the mayor needs to be on his way, so we're going to let you come forward with some of these St. Paul bills that are up next.
And if is me here, I guess you'll let him. He'll handle it.
It's a big St. Paul.
Spring, that'll be Fishbach. Whole spring would be Fishbach, right?
Oh no, right now. She's not ready.
She's gonna see. I'll take it. It's a couple of more. There's two in here.
Which one you want to take?
Let them decide.
Yeah, we do it together.
Okay. So we're going to present the services.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Mullen and I are going to present these bills together, Senate Files 2709 2705. Obviously, we want Mayor Coleman and Councilmember Lantry to take the bulk of the time in testifying. Let me just, maybe we could just speak to our bills at the outset for a few seconds. The bill that I have, which is Senate File 2709, deals with the debt for the St. Paul River Center Convention Center. I think members have in the packet some information about that. Let me just make it very clear from the outset that St. Paul finds itself in a very unique position. This is the only convention center that has been built without any state support. Obviously, the legislature provided the local option sales tax, which has been utilized. But every other convention center that has either been built or is being contemplated to be built has been done so, has been built through state support. Most notably, and I recognize, Mr. Chairman and members, that we're not here to look at other geographies around the state, but kind of, I'm trying to glance around the table, Senator Parisot and Senator Fishbach will recall in 1998 when the state legislature provided a significant amount of support for the Minneapolis Convention Center. Now, obviously, Minneapolis has used local option sales taxes, convention center. There was also a significant grant made by the state legislature. And kind of glance around the table, I think, Senator Kubley, you were a member of the House at that point. St. Paul went ahead without any state support other than the ability to levy the local option sales tax. And what's happened now, Mr. Chairman, members, is that the discussions that took place at that point, and there were discussions that that suggested that St. Paul might have some difficulty in being able to provide ongoing support, has happened. And so we need the support, as has been done for every other convention center. So Mayor Coleman can talk about the convention center, what it means to St. Paul, what it means to Minnesota. Senator Moore might want to make a couple comments at the outset about her bill, which is the other half of this.
Mr. Chairman, members, you have the language of Senate File 2705 in front of you. It is asking for forgiveness and the remaining state loan payments for the arena. We are coming to you to ask for this to allow St. Paul to reinvest and capitalize on a thriving part of our community. First of all, the city is going to use this revenue also to fix the funding model at the River Center, as Senator Cohen has stated. And so I'm going to, in the interest of time, have our witnesses here speak to the issues. But Senate File 2705 is asking for the forgiveness of the remaining of the state loan for payments of on the arena.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Chris Coleman. I have the honor and pleasure of being mayor of the city of St. Paul. I want to just note for the record that Harry Melander, head of the St. Paul Building Trades, is here. Jay Rykunik, who is the chair of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, intended to be here, but she got buried under 2 feet of snow, I understand, in Wisconsin. Chris Johnson, who's president of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, is also here as well in support of this bill. I also want to thank the committee and all the members for passing this bill. This initiative for the event district in the city of St. Paul out of the committee last year. We appreciated the support. It did end up on the governor's desk. The governor vetoed the bill, saying that he wasn't quite sure what the purpose and the intent of it, so we came back this year with a renewed commitment and renewed vigor to get this legislation passed and signed by the governor with some further detail that the governor had requested. We are coming back again this year and hope to get your support for the event district. And we believe that there is, as Senator Cohen suggested, a sense of urgency for this district. St. Paul is proud to be home of the event district that includes the River Center Complex, Roy Wilkins Auditorium, XL Energy Center, 317, the old Minnesota Historic Minnesota Club building, the Ordway Center for the Performing Arts, and the Science Museum of Minnesota. These cultural, educational, entertainment venues are they're an excellent benefit to the entire state of Minnesota. And they are a great part of, I think, what makes the capital city such a wonderful place for all Minnesotans. We believe that this event district enriches our entire state. It certainly provides lots of opportunities for children that come from around, whether they're coming to visit some of the museums or whether they're coming to participate in one of the high school sports events. This district has a tremendous economic impact for the city of St. Paul. Nearly 4.5 million people attend an event annually at one of these events, at one of these venues. There are 1,100 people or more that are employed by this district. The event district generates nearly $200 million in economic impact from purchasing and other spending. Each convention attendee spends approximately $318 per day on meals, lodging, entertainment, and related costs. And the public-private development of the Cleveland Circle, which this legislation would help, will provide for 350 construction jobs, and we believe that we may be able to begin construction as soon as fall of 2008 or shortly after the convention. You may have heard there's a small convention coming to town in the city of St. Paul in September. The area of what, that we refer to as Cleveland Circle is being used as a staging area for the convention, primarily for media trucks, but we hope as soon as the convention is over, we may be able to break ground on a new facility that will include many different facets, including retail, medical office, a potential community ice garden that will expand some of the activities that we have around the Xcel Energy Center. At this point, I would like to turn it over to Senator, the daughter of the former senator, as a son of a former senator. I'd like to, this may be a first, actually. I'd like to introduce our council president and a member of the River Center and Visitors Association, Kathy Lantry.
Thank you, Mayor.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. The River Center Convention Center has an urgent need for debt relief. Right now, we're using our all of our operating expenses on year-to-year capital maintenance costs, and this is really important that we be able to plow that money back into the event district. Clearly, the problem stems from 1993 and the original financing model from that time. It was hoped at the time that the citywide sales tax, coupled with the operating revenues, could fund a new convention center and would be sufficient to construct and maintain the $65 million facility. 15 years later, it's clear to everyone that that has not been adequately considered in the original budget. Until our capital maintenance financing issues are addressed, the convention center and the event district will not make significant progress. This request is also so important so that we can stop using those operating dollars for debt service and start use operating dollars to catch up on maintenance backlog and to begin marketing our event district to generate more sales tax dollars. We believe that initially we will generate at least $200,000 annually in additional sales tax alone to the state of Minnesota. This will also allow us to begin work on new development projects within the event district, trying to do an improved physical connection between the Ordway and the Science Museum, begin planning for Roy Wilkins' renovation, and support the public portion and the new development, the project the mayor talked about at Cleveland Circle. This River Center was built without any state assistance, and it does not compete with other Minnesota convention centers outside the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And this event district will be a combination of the results of a decade worth of public and private investment, including the transit center that's across the street, Xcel Energy Center, the convention center, the parks that are around there, Rice Park, Landmarks Park, and, of course, the upgrades to the Central Library in downtown St. Paul. In closing, we're asking for your support today so that we can have this important economic development tool for the entire region. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that this flyer was distributed or given to all the members, so there's a good map of what we're talking about when we talk about the event district, and the two bills are summarized. We will welcome any questions.
Questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. Senator Cohn.
Chair, but if I could just make one other comment, and certainly as somebody who's neither of my parents served in the state Senate, nor did Senator Moaz, but if we can offer a Senator, there was a reference by Councilmember Lantry that I thought appropriate in terms of what took place in 93. Senator Pappas and I were probably the people most involved with the enactment of the sales tax, the local option sales tax. And the expectation at that point was we knew it would be difficult, but we thought there would be the opportunity they have St. Paul, through that sales tax, be able to afford the establishment of the River Center complex. And clearly, as Councilmember Lantry has pointed out, financial models for these kinds of efforts have changed over the years, and the times have caught up to St. Paul. St. Paul wanted to do it on its own. That was the thought at that time with then the previous Mayor Coleman, that we would have the ability to do so. But clearly, the times have passed us by in that regard. So we're kind of a victim of our own success to the extent that our effort was probably the initial effort in the state when there was a different model for these kinds of projects. And as indicated by both Mayor Coleman, Councilmember Lantry, Senator Moi, the River Center complex is one that, you know, if you take a look at the state statute in terms of regional significance, it goes beyond regional significance. It certainly is not as large a complex as, say, the Minneapolis Convention Center, but is very much the equal in terms of being a magnet for statewide and beyond the state kinds of activities.
And before we go, Mr. Jensen has a suggestion, too.
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe Senator Cohen, looking at this bill and the reduction on the convention center, are these numbers from the 2007 session, and shouldn't the principal be reduced in, say, a year's time?
It's something maybe I could ask Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, or Senator Cohen, we could review these before they go out, too, and get your agreement on them.
Seen some shaking of heads, so...
Hi, my name is Eric Williams. I'm the CFO of the St. Paul River Center CVA. And I believe in the bill that there is the current numbers for the defeasance of the convention center bonds. So they have been reduced.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mayor and Council members, and Senator Cohen, Senator Moi as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members.
Mr. Chair, can I just sit here?
Yeah, go. Sure.
I apologize to anybody. I have a public safety meeting next door that I thought if you would let me do this, then I can run over there for my committee.
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, I'm proud to bring to you Senate File 2483, which is asking for a request for a wonderful youth organization, the St. Paul Youth Services. And, Mr. Chair, I believe that I thought I had asked for an amendment to be drafted, but maybe that was just me thinking in my dream. So I wonder if you would indulge me and see if one of the members in the committee would be willing to take the number at line 1.7 and line 1.14, reduce that from 750 to 500,000.
Senator Dibble moves it on line 1.7.
We don't have the bill.
Ms. Chair, I think the number was stated incorrectly as 2714.
2714 it is. I apologize. I have two sets of notes.
I'm sorry. Okay. We're working on Senate File 2714. Senator Dibble moves it on line 1.17 and 1.14. We reduce the number from 750 to what was it, Senator Moore?
500. 500.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
So that would be 500,000. And we have been able to, not $500, but 500,000.
No, that wasn't my motion.
Since this bill was introduced last year, we've worked very hard and we've been able to raise enough money to buy down the request. And so that's why we're coming to you with a lower number, and I'm sure that makes a difference to the committee members. But here is somebody who is much more qualified to speak on the project to answer questions. That's Nancy Latourneau, who is the executive director for St. Paul Youth Services.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Latourneau. I'm the executive director of St. Paul Youth Services, have been with the organization for 17 years now. This organization started back in 1972, actually as a department of the city of St. Paul. We were housed at the police department reporting to then Deputy Chief McCutcheon. Some of you might remember that name. Our role is to work with kids that are starting to get in trouble and do pretty much whatever it takes to get them back on the right track. I don't know if anybody here on the committee is aware of one of the programs that we do with Ramsey County. Folks have been up here at the legislature talking about it. It's really a national model called the All Children Excel Program, where we work with kids under 10 who research says because of their young involvement in delinquency already are likely to be the chronic violent offenders of the future. We've had tremendous success with these kids, and without the kind of intervention that we do with them, the research says they would cost the state approximately $2 million apiece. And I know that with the ever-rising cost of housing adult criminals, we really believe that our organization has a profound effect as we continue to work with some of those kinds of kids in an urban area. And I think some of you might have been on a bus tour that we did, might have heard a little bit about what we've done, what we do in this community. I think the other thing I would point out that this building has created an opportunity for us to begin working with libraries. I don't know, it might be going on tonight. We just had a visit last week from Fox 9 News. Because of our work with the St. Paul Public Libraries and potentially other libraries around the state, it might come as a shock to some people to know that librarians are struggling with the advent of computers, are bringing in all kinds of kids into their libraries, kids that our librarians, frankly, have not been trained and are having some trouble managing. These things have gotten to the point at both the Rice Street Library and the Arlington Library in St. Paul that they're starting to assign armed police officers at the libraries to manage the situations. We've been able to go into several of these libraries and really work with the staff to manage the situations that they're dealing with and eliminate that need in our public libraries. I know that in some of the trainings we're doing now with the libraries, we're getting librarians from all over the state coming and saying we're having the same problem in our communities and asking for help as well. So this is something that we're going to see growing in the future as one of the impacts that we'll have. And I think with that, I'll...
We'll be glad to take some questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Letourneau. Any questions from the committee? I think it's a wonderful program. Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you coming for us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Senator Dahl, are you ready?
We're ready.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think this is the first time I've been before your committee, and I thank you for the opportunity. You might have some packets, I think, regarding this request. In the heart of my district is a place called the Heart of the City in Burnsville. It's developing a downtown area that's been ongoing for some time, and we reached this point where we've got what we're looking at here with your packets is kind of the crown jewel of that development. And we're looking at partnering with the state. Right at this point, with my district has Bloomington and Burnsville in it. We're really nearly 100% developed as it is. So we got to look at redevelopment, and so we need the tools and the help of the state to partner on redeveloping some of these areas. This is our request. I brought Mayor Elizabeth Kautz with me to kind of describe what we want to do.
Welcome to the committee, Mayor.
Thank you, members, for the opportunity to address you and to talk to you about this wonderful redevelopment initiative that we have in Burnsville called the Heart of the City. It's a 54-acre site, members, that we have worked on for the last 12 to 13 years to redevelop. At one point, this particular area, 54-acre site, was really becoming quite blighted. And we're seeing areas where crime was beginning to move in. And we chose this area to redevelop, worked with over 1,000 of our residents to bring together a vision for this area, and developed a mixed-use development with transit orientation. And it is an area that has already seen about $150 million of investment. And there are about 10 redevelopment initiatives going on at this time since 2001, and a total of over 300 units of residence. Some 20% of that is affordable. And there is access to two transit stations. And this 54-acre site, as I mentioned earlier, at one point was only yielding $166,000. And it would have been even more expensive if we had allowed it to fall into blight and become crime-infested. Today, with the developments that are there, we are happy to report that we yield about $1.5 million in tax base, and at its completion, $3 million. So we see that what we're doing is redeveloping Burnsville, where it is 98% built out. The Performing Arts Center that we're here before you, members of the legislature and the Senate, is an area that, as I said, took over 1,000 of our citizens coming to see this vision. And they've also invested in public art in the area. And that one of the elements that was very important to all of them is the arts and a performing arts center. And we see it that it isn't just for the citizens of Burnsville, but we also see it that it is a regional amenity. And why do we think this? It is because Burnsville is right where the interstate divides from the south. We see over 150,000 people each day in Burnsville who come to shop because we're a regional shopping center, and also to work. At nighttime, we are 62,000 in Burnsville, but during the day we see 150,000 people in our community. So we are a regional center. We believe that there are about over 600,000 people south of the river. And the river is a psychological boundary for people. Now, we believe that the people south of the river are deserving of the arts and culture. And that's why we're here, to ask for your support and partnership, that you partner with us in this particular facility. It is about 64,000 square feet, 1,000-seat main theater, and 150 black box. And yes, the building is now in under construction. And you may ask, why are we here at this point? We were here last year, and we hope that you will hear us and afford us the opportunity to partner and to make this available to the citizens south of the Minnesota River and to the border of the state down to Iowa. We think it's a fair and equitable issue. This opportunity is not unlike others that the state has shared with the metropolitan area and other areas in greater Minnesota. So we would like for you to hear us south of the Minnesota River and partner with us and make this facility available for citizens south of the Minnesota River and not just Burnsville, because we believe it is a regional amenity. And we're happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mayor. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question of Mayor Kautz, but I would like to say that she's a visionary mayor, and she has been at the front of a lot of the nicer things that have happened in Burnsville.
That's good. We're glad to hear that.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Madam Mayor. You might want to tell the committee a little bit about the inhabitants of these redeveloped housing units in that part of the city. The mayor is one of those. I just thought maybe she ought to mention that.
I believe in what we do, and yes, one of the things that we do in Burnsville is that we know that we're 98% built out, and we have no more land, and we have a limited housing stock. So if we want our schools to have young families move in with student with possibility with students, then those of us who are empty nesters need to allow our homes to be there for younger families. And so I did. We sold our home to a younger family with 2.5 children. Half is because one is still in the tummy. And my husband and I moved to the heart of the city where there is product for empty nesters and product for those young people who are wanting to build equity. And so there's some affordable housing. So thank you for the question, Senator.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll echo Senator Pariseau's comment. Mayor Kautz has been a leader that many of us who are interested in issues that affect the whole region have had some contact with her because she's been a region-wide leader. I just had a quick question. Did you say that this proposal was contained in the bill last year that met
We were here last year, and it did make it in the bonding bill. Our TIF did. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that it goes through again, but this particular one didn't make it, and so we're here asking for your support and help. And we're big on partnerships, and I want to thank the state also. One of the things that we've done, and Senator Pariseau, you know about this, it's the water treatment plant, so thank you for that. It's being built, and this is a great environmental issue, and Senator Pariseau also knows that one of the things that we do in Dakota County is try to leverage our resources so that we can continue to deliver great services to our citizens and reduce our costs, our Dakota Communications Center. And so those are some of the things. And so we believe that with all of the work that we're trying to do in transportation, that these are important things for us to talk about. And we're here because we need culture and the arts south of the river and would like your support.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Mayor and Senator Dahl, for your presentation. Keep up the good work in Burnsville, and we'll see if we can help you out.
Great. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Chair, members, thank you very much.
And thank you, Senator Pariseau and Senator Dibble, for your great words, and thank you, Senator, for the question.
Because why not? Fish hot corn. It's the only way we can keep corn in the committee is if we don't. If we, I guess they called Dibble up earlier. I don't know how this happened. But
not me.
Huh? Who
Hey,
Senator Corn, it's capped. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm here to present Senate File 2772. And kind of a lengthy bill, Mr. Chair, because it sets up a new effort at the state level, a new partnership with local communities. But it, in order to do so, we're looking for a little bonding money to establish the resources. Committee is aware that regardless of what happens with the transportation bill on Thursday, although I think it's going to pass and ultimately be passed into law, it's clear that we're moving to a region and a transportation system where transit is going to play an increasingly important role. There's just no way to avoid that. It's vital. It's important. And transit serves a number of very, very important goals and functions. When we talk about transit, we talk about goals clearly around getting folks where they need to go, the transportation function of transit. It certainly has a tremendous environmental benefit, and if you look to the Climate Change Advisory Group that recently submitted a number of policy recommendations, transit is a big part of that. But more importantly, transit and how it influences land use and the efficient use of land in the metropolitan area is an important goal and function that we need to pursue. To realize the greatest benefit of transit and important public transportation investments, a number of complementary policies need to be put in place. And related to land use in particular, to make the best and most efficient use, and we just heard the presentation about the heart of the city in Burnsville. We saw the kind of vital development that the city of St. Paul was talking about with its events district. A variety of housing, access to services, jobs, and cultural entertainment opportunities, the walkability of those districts, access to education, and on, are important to pursue. What this bill seeks to do is to establish a loan program. Like I said, the resources would be established by selling some bonds, but it would be a permanent loan fund that would be for loans that are made to local communities to help them pay for the supporting infrastructure that would surround transit areas. It requires local communities to establish a transit improvement area, sets forth the criteria and the principles that underlie that. It asks them to submit a transit area improvement plan. If you look on page 2, it sets forth what components are involved in the establishment of that plan. The Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development can then make loans to those local units of government for those purposes of paying for the supporting infrastructure in these transit areas. This is a term we call transit-oriented development. Loans may not exceed $2 million each, and they're to be matched with other sources and repaid entirely at the end of a 10-year term. And the loan can go to pay for all sorts of things, but it can't go to pay for the transit service itself or anything that is directly related to transit service. So I don't want folks to be confused at that point.
Senator Dibble, I don't want to interrupt you, but this is really a long bonding bill. And I'm just wondering, is the policy, is it your intent for the policy to go in the bonding bill, or is it your policy to go into the transportation bill, or there's a bond provision here also.
Right,
that was
right.
Recommended, but I don't, you want this in the bonding bill, or what are you thinking?
Whatever council advises it. Certainly the policy framework that the bond proceeds would support can certainly be enacted separately, and the slice that deals with the bonds can be carved out and stuck in the bonding bill, I think, as well.
But
Mr. Chair,
some advice here. Let's see. Let's just, because I understand what you're doing, but I haven't seen this much language in a bonding bill ever. So I'm just thinking that this might be some policy that we might put someplace else.
You can certainly do that.
And I would think that would probably not be a bad idea, because just in case you don't get the bonding money, at least you get the policy enacted, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but I certainly hope we get the bonding money.
Okay. Okay.
But yes, Mr. Chair, that's a great question, because I have had that thought. And if the bonding doesn't occur for whatever reason, and I'm pretty sure Finance Chair isn't going to give any general fund money to put in this, we'll see, to at least establish the policy framework so that we can fill this up with some money at some point in the future would be great.
And let me hear Mr. Jensen here.
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a transit improvement account indeed now. This policy would change some of the purposes of that money, and I think it probably should go to the Transportation Policy Committee for review. You can always add money to the current account if the Transportation Policy Committee agrees to change the purposes.
Well, Mr.
Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not discussing what you or Senator Dibble should do, but obviously, relative to what Mr. Jensen mentioned, if the decision of this division is that the Transportation Policy Committee should take a look at that, we have that anomaly where the Transportation Policy is the same as the Finance Division, so it's all within the Finance Committee, and we don't need any kind of floor action to refer Senator Dibble's bill to the Transportation Policy Committee. I can simply do it. If that's what the members would like done.
Okay. Do we need any official action here to carve out the bonding part, or do you want to send, because you don't want to send the bonding part to the Transportation Policy Committee, right?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that this bill would go to Senator Cohen's committee for that referral. I'm just not sure.
If it's going to be with transportation policy, that's within the finance committee. So we don't need to send it. We could just keep it here, and I could refer it to the transportation division.
That works. I'm just wondering about the bond part. The bond part we want to keep here, right? So we should carve out whatever bond part. Is that okay with you, Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, yes. I believe that's where the language you'd find on page 5, the last two sections.
The last two sections, okay. Okay, subdivision 2 or 3. So Senator Dibble moves. What would be the appropriate motion here? Oh, we don't want to send the entire thing over to you, or do we?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think it'd be fine to keep the. You know, what we're doing is with bond issues, keeping them within the particular division for recommendations to Senator Lanxess committee. So I would think certainly keep the bond section of it here.
Okay. All right. So that would be to delete subdivision 2 and 3 on page 5 would be the appropriate motion.
And then send it to the
Okay. So Senator Dibble moves to delete line 5.6 through 5.14. And Senator Cohen will take care of the rest of the bill. But I don't think that's part of the motion.
Did they ever call you lucky?
Well, Senator Cohen's going to take care of it. We're just going to delete the. Are we deleting this, or are we deleting this part?
Deleting most of the paragraph. Sending the rest.
Wouldn't you want to keep the bottom here? Yeah. So do we want to delete everything but what I just said?
I think that's what we want to do. Or not, no?
Mr. Chair, because the bill itself is just within the Finance Committee, if we just delete that section that that you talked about and it gets moved over to the Finance Committee, the bill that the Transportation Committee will then take up will be this entire bill minus the two subdivisions regarding bonding.
So we want to delete everything but what I said.
Nope, we want to do exactly what you said, delete that. And then if this committee decides to make recommendations regarding bonding to Senator Lanxess, it can just be included in that document. It doesn't actually need a bill to serve as a vehicle. So you're doing the exact right thing.
Okay. And Senator Dibble moves to delete subdivision 2 and subdivision 3 on page 5. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, go ahead. Now you can finish your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now we'll tell you why this is such a wonderful idea. Mr. Chair, this idea has been developed in conjunction with work of by Minnesota Solutions, the League of Minnesota Cities, and Metro Cities. Mr. Chair, we have Louis Jamboy here. From Metro Cities, who is going to share some thoughts with us. We also have a couple of other witnesses who have been working on these ideas at a statewide, and I'll emphasize this has statewide applicability. We have Jim Urkel from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and you may be familiar with his report, Getting on Board, and how regions can take best economic advantage of transit investments. And I believe this has been handed out. And we have Dave Van Hatter from Transit for Livable Communities. Okay, we're going to have Bonnie Bollock talk from Minnesota Solutions quickly, and then literally a minute or two from Dave Van Hatter and Jim Urkel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Bollich, and I represent Minnesota Solutions, and I have worked with Metro Cities and the League for about 2 years on this proposal, and it grew out of the need of many of our cities to provide some sort of money for infrastructure to shape communities around transit stations so that they are user-friendly and that we can make the most efficient use of the huge, really huge investment that the state and federal government is making in public transit. And I don't want to say any more because I think it's the development aspects of it are pretty obvious. I think what isn't quite as obvious is, I think, some of the interest of the other groups that you're going to hear from in a moment.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go next. Robley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Urkel. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I direct MCEA's Land Use and Transportation Program. For some time, MCEA has been working for a well-planned and fully funded transit system for the region, and MCEA has been very interested in the environmental, social, and economic benefits that would flow to the region from the more compact and mixed-use forms of development that transit supports. MCEA supports Senate File 2772. Transit serves three basic economic functions, basic mobility, congestion management, and location efficiency. That is, the potential for supporting more compact and mixed-use forms of development. In terms of economic performance, a region receives its highest rate of return on its investment in transit from its development function. The loan program established by Senate File 2772 would add another tool to the transit-oriented development toolbox and help with the public improvements that are needed to take full advantage of transit's development function. The potential for transit-oriented development in the region is substantial. If the region's transit system is fully funded and built out, it could include an additional 75 to 100 stations and support more than 100,000 new households within a half mile of those stations. In other words, the region could use 2% of its land to support almost 25% of the estimated growth in households between 2000 and 2030. Although the areas surrounding many stations will successfully develop on their own, others will need help in dealing with the economic and environmental effects of past development. The public improvements that would be supported by the loans from DEED through Senate File 2772 will not guarantee success for transit-oriented development, but will certainly make it much more likely that this region will be able to take full advantage of transit's transforming role in urban form. I hope you will support Senate File 2772. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Van Hattem. I'm with Transit for Livable Communities. I also spent 6 years in downtown Minneapolis and along I-494 promoting transit options, various commuting options. I hope our name kind of conveys why we're supportive of this bill. We have to make the connection between transit and communities, and we know that people want these options. There was a recent national study by the National Realtors Association found that 75% would prefer to see compact development with transit options, walkable communities, rather than to address congestion rather than building our roadways. 71% of seniors, according to the AARP, would like to live within walking distance of transit, and we know that that's a growing segment of the population. Essentially, the problem is that the market's not providing that option, and I won't go into a lot of detail on why that's the case, but one of the reasons, obviously, is to this point we haven't made that major investment in transit. We hope to do so soon, and when we do, we will see huge benefits if we couple transit with land use. In 2002, the Metropolitan Council, under an independent administration and with the best consultants in the world, projected that the transit investment, along with these kind of supportive land use policies, could save the region, the metro region, $2 to $3 billion over that time frame. So that's equivalent to essentially the cost of the transit investment. So congestion savings, more walkable communities, healthier communities are all added benefits. One last benefit of this investment is that, again, nationally, we found that these more compact communities that have the variety of modal choices, walking, biking, transit, can reduce travel by 20 to 30%. So that, again, is very important in terms of our greenhouse gas emission reduction strategy in terms of having healthy and convenient transit options for all of our residents. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments of the committee? Senator Cohen, do we need a motion to move this back to the full finance?
No.
You sure?
Yeah, because we're in the finance committee now.
All right. Okay. Any other comments? Senator Dibble, final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Senator Cohen, you want to go next?
How many got left there?
Just a few.
25 bills are.
Senator Cohen, I'm supposed to point out here that you're a state senator like all of us are, but you're kind of a special state senator because you don't just carry things for your district, you're caring for other districts also.
That's right. I'm a statewide state senator. Exactly. Minnesota state senator.
Would that be at large? Vote in anybody's chair?
Welcome, Senator Cohen.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. This is an effort that Senator Dibble and I have been working on, and this is an effort to seek some improvements for Minnesota Orchestra and Orchestra Hall. Let me just, if you allow me, there are two witnesses I'll introduce in a minute. Mr. Jack Eukster, who is the chairman of the Minnesota Orchestra, and Mr. Michael Sutton, who is a violinist with the orchestra. But before listening to them, let me just make a couple of introductory comments. Obviously, members of the legislature have heard from me over the years relative to a variety of arts proposals, whether it be particular arts projects, whether it be the appropriations for the state arts board, or even possibly constitutional amendments. But the original arts event I ever attended, I have this very vague memory when I was a little kid, and just to date myself, it was a young people's concert that my mother took me to with Antal Doradi and the Minneapolis Symphony. So Mr. Sutton is saying, boy, yeah, I have a very vague memory of it. That was the original arts event, and I have been a subscriber of the Minnesota Orchestra for a number of years. And obviously, we're all familiar with the orchestra and familiar with what the orchestra does. But let me try to just offer a little bit of context and the reason that this bill is being presented. The orchestra has outgrown Orchestra Hall. When Orchestra Hall was opened, I believe, in 1967, it was a building for the Times. But now, given the size of the state, given the usage of Orchestra Hall, not simply by the orchestra, but by the community in a variety of ways that Mr. Eukster and Mr. Sutton will testify to, Orchestra Hall simply doesn't work. But that's coupled with the fact that at this time, the orchestra has reached a level arguably unparalleled in its history since 1903. And let me just offer a couple of comments. Members have the packet in front of them that describes a lot of what the orchestra has been doing. But with the arrival of music director Osmo Vanska 5 years ago, the orchestra has reached an artistic level where it is now considered among the significant orchestras in the world and maybe possibly the singular orchestra in North America. Let me just read a couple of quotes, one of which is in the packet, one of which is not. In the fall of 2006, the orchestra performed for the first time at the BBC Proms concert in London. And the reviewer for the London Times said at that time, out of nowhere, it seems the world has acquired a new superstar band with a maestro to match. And in fact, Mr. Sutton can tell me if I'm misstating this, but I think the year before, Director Vanska had been honored as the North American Conductor of the Year. In December of 2006, the New York Times wrote, this is not in the packet, but actually I have it in the office, the article in the office, and we checked the quote beforehand. New York Times, December 2006. On a cold night in December, the Minnesota Orchestra, if not the best orchestra in North America, is certainly the most important orchestra in North America. So, members, when you take a look at the statute that sets out the requirement for these kinds of efforts to have regional or statewide significance, certainly this is an effort that goes beyond regional or statewide. Arguably, it's national, and you can even make the argument that it's international. If you were to go to Europe, you would not hear about the Minnesota Twins or the Minnesota Vikings, the Minnesota Timberwolves. You might hear about 3M, but I would argue the only two Minnesota organizations you would hear about would be the Minnesota Orchestra and the Guthrie Theater. Those are the organizations that are known beyond the borders of the United States. And people in Europe who follow such things identify those organizations with Minnesota, with the exception maybe of 3M or some of the other major companies, That's what you hear about in Europe. So this suggests the importance of the orchestra to Minnesota. Mr. Eukster and Mr. Sutton can talk about what they're doing with the orchestra and why this effort will take, as the orchestra has now been taken to the next level artistically, why this effort will take the orchestra to the next level in terms of what the orchestra can do for the state of Minnesota.
And so, Senator Cohen, I did go to the concert in Hibbing when they were up in Hibbing at the auditorium at Hibbing High School, and it was exceptional. There was no doubt about it.
And Mr. Chairman, I think in the packet, and I think Mr. Eukster was going to talk about this, there is a map that shows where the orchestra has performed throughout the state.
Mr. Eukster, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I have the great fun of chairing the Minnesota Orchestral Association, and I also have a person who has got the local cold, and so I have my voice is a little faltering, so forgive me for that. But it's my pleasure to be here to discuss the aspirations that we have for Orchestra Hall. Senator Cohen has done a great job of talking about how this has become a top orchestra in the United States with earnest aspirations to be a top orchestra, the top orchestra, maybe, on the world stage. And we're very happy to be making tours, trips to New York, to Carnegie Hall, and soon to Avery Fisher Hall, but also last year to Europe for many countries, and that's what builds that reputation. We are called the Minnesota Orchestral Association in part because though we anchor a little bit of the west side of downtown Minneapolis, in reality, this is the one arts organization that takes itself on the road throughout the state. Since 1903, when we started, actually 1907, we've been to 650 concerts in 50 cities throughout the Minnesota area. And in fact, this week, we're embarking on a four-city tour, which I'm going to enjoy being part of the first two cities, which will be Jackson and Marshall, and then on to Willmar and Cokato. And it was just last summer, I think, we were in Winona. The orchestra does 200 concerts a year, most of them at Orchestra Hall, but many in other places as well. In addition, we do about another 90 concerts that involve other types of music. 400,000 people come to the concerts, 200,000 people listen on regional radio, and frankly, because we do performances on national public radio, we have millions that hear this this orchestra outside of the Minnesota area. On the financial front, last year, we balanced, and that we're really proud of balancing, a $30 million budget. And that was a real effort, and not many orchestras in the United States have accomplished that. This is a golden period for our orchestra. Osmo Banska has done a wonderful job in bringing a marvelous group of musicians forward to the best standards. We got nominated for the best orchestra performance at the Grammys this year. And so all of that is exciting and leads us to our building for the future with the renovation and, more importantly, the expansion of Orchestra Hall. So let me talk about that for a moment. We're here today because we're requesting in the bonding program $3 million for the beginning of the process to plan the renovations. Planning funds will allow us to create a solid, fiscally responsible plan to rejuvenate Orchestra Hall and PV Plaza that we're right next to for new audiences in this next century or in the century we're in. Let me just tell you a bit about that. Orchestra Hall was built many years ago, as Dick indicated, and it was done for $15 million, and virtually all of that money was put into the hall. If you know the facility, you've been there, there's this great big brick hall, which is the place, the auditorium where the music is played, and it's isolated from the lobby and the back room area around it. Most of the money went into that hall, and it's a very, very good hall. The lobby, on the other hand, was built to last 15 or 20 years. It was undersized. In fact, we have only 6 square feet in the lobby per person who would come to a concert on a full night, a full house night, 6 square feet. And, of course, it was built with inexpensive materials that you've probably all seen. So it really needs a new face to it. Over 30 years, we've reimagined this new orchestra hall and have done it with four priorities. They are, first, an expanded lobby, about a doubling of the size of the lobby. As I indicated, we have almost no space, and it's particularly difficult during intermissions, particularly for the ladies' restrooms, as you might expect. And we really need to improve the lobby for the concerts, but more importantly, to improve the size and the availability of spaces in the lobby to support downtown Minneapolis, to support groups coming in from other areas to spend time with students. We have over 80,000 students per year. There was approximately 85,000 last year who were part of our outreach programs, either coming to Concert Hall and listening to a concert and being taught, or working with the musicians like Michael. But we just don't have much space to do that with. We need to modernize the hall itself, the inner core of the auditorium. It has stood the test of time. It's a great acoustical hall, but we need to provide some of the new electronics that need to go into a hall of this nature so people can see what's going on from all seats, so different types of music, particularly amplified music, can be heard, so that the players on the stage in the orchestra can hear themselves, which is very difficult, and therefore it's hard to play together. And they do it marvelously, but with a great impediment. So that's number two. Number three is to renovate the backstage and expand the backstage. We have very little space for storage of equipment. We have virtually no practice rooms. We have no rooms to work with students. So we'd really like to provide an improved and much more functional backstage. And lastly, and with great enthusiastic support from the state of the city of Minnesota, Minneapolis, and Mayor Rybeck, we want to renovate and reinvigorate PV Plaza and make it a place where where concerts can occur, where we can continue it as the anchor, the outdoor anchor of our Summerfest activity, and just make it a great place for meeting in Minneapolis, a place where a whole bunch of the restaurants are. It kind of has become the restaurant center. So we want to collaborate with the city on that. In conclusion, I'd say that the Minnesota Orchestra is a great statewide treasure. The Orchestral Society or Association believes it's our job to reach out to all parts of the state, and we hope that we do that well. It's unfortunate that we have a great downtown location next to PV Plaza, next to the restaurants, close to the convention center, and now it's time for that venue to live up to its full potential. At this point, I'd like to introduce Michael Sutton, who's going to tell us a little bit about the musical side of things, and then we'll take questions, but thank you.
Before we go to Mr. Sutton, that was just a great statistic. You said 6 square feet. How many people can you seat in the hall?
It's a little over 2,000.
Over 2,000. Now I got to imagine that. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yes. The lobby right now is about 30,000 feet, but only 15,000 of it is functional. The rest is in restrooms. It's in corridors and so forth. We hope to take that up to about 50,000 square feet.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Say your name,
Mr. Chairman,
please.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Sutton. I play violin in the orchestra. I have been here for 10.5 years. I'm one of the only native Minnesotans in the orchestra. There are 6 of us, and I actually am from Minneapolis. It's a great honor to be a member of this orchestra, and I think we're at a really wonderful point where we can springboard from here. Just to elaborate a little bit on some of the things that Jack was talking about, the lobby fire code, I believe, is about for 1,800 people, and we actually seat 2,200 people, so that math doesn't work very well. All of that white thing, as you said, was temporary. There are severe problems backstage. It's kind of embarrassing when somebody who is wheelchair-bound, like the great Ixop Perlman, has to take a freight elevator downstairs, albeit decorated with kids' things. That's a little embarrassing. And we would love to have more things going on in the lobby. And I don't know how to describe what the things I could talk about are acoustics if you like, but it's really what's most relevant is the fact that we're not always able to do the best performances that we can. And we find this out because we play in all the great halls in the world, and we come back home, and suddenly we are having a difficult time hearing across the stage. I mean, we do play with the conductor, but we also need to hear from across the stage. Now, the guys in the back playing the percussion and the brass, they are having to do something bizarre, and they can't play with what they hear or with what they see. They have to anticipate that. So there's some tweaks that can be done fairly simply, and we had a great acoustician come in and take a look at it, so that's already taken care of. It would be just wonderful if you could give us some seed money so that we could kind of get things going. I think we've selected an architect, Jim Dayton, with fourth generation Dayton, who just his most recent building is the McPhail Center for Music. He's a Frank Gehry student, so we have a lot of things in place, and we need just a little bit of help from you.
Mr. Sutton, were you up in Hibbing?
Yes, sir.
How was that stage?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, that's an amazing. For people who haven't been to the Hibbing High School, it was built with iron ore money, and it's an exceptional acoustic thing. It's modeled after something in New York that I don't think is there anymore. It's got Milanese chandelier, crystal.
I know gold doorknobs. I heard all that.
Never
saw it, but you heard.
It's ridiculous. I mean, the I was in your bathroom here. Their bathroom's nicer than yours. So,
about that.
Well, we may want to secede. You never know.
Mr. Chair, if I might step back in for a moment, the map doesn't show that we were in Chisholm, but I learned last night from some people that grew up there that we have been in Chisholm a couple of times as well. I'm not sure I know the venue, and it was in the 70s or 80s, but anyway. And I don't mean to correct my musician friend here, but if I were playing, he would be able to correct me constantly. So since I'm not playing any instrument here, we have had a local architect, Jim Dayton, work on some preliminary thoughts and designs on the outside and the interior spaces of the hall so that we can have a sense of where we're going before we start asking for this planning money. But we haven't hired the permanent architect yet, and we will establish a committee that will do that in a careful, very careful way.
And is the total project $30 million? Does that sound about right? Or?
Well, the total project will be in the range of $90 million, and we will be coming back if we can get this planning money now, we'll be coming back in 2 years seeking approximately an additional $30 million of bonding to support the $90 to $95 million project.
Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, just a couple other things quickly. In the packet, there's a detailing, I think, for each of the committee members as to what the orchestra has been doing in our individual districts. And this doesn't directly relate to the building, but it's illustrative of what the orchestra is doing in the larger community and where an enhancement of the building will be of supplemental help. Mr. Sutton's one of the musicians, and I think it's, maybe 50 or so, maybe half the orchestra, involved in the Adopt a School program.
At least.
We're at least half the musicians, maybe more.
Yeah.
And members might be familiar with that program, where the Adopt a School program is set up so that a particular musician works with students from a particular school. In many instances, these are schools that otherwise wouldn't have access to these kinds of activities. And it's illustrative that Mr. Sutton is a musician in the orchestra. It's not just simply, although there's lots of time with practice, with performance, is not limiting his role to that, but is actively involved using his art in the community as well. So, again, illustrates what the orchestra is doing, and hope members will take a look at this.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just say that this facility is one of the great reasons why Senate District 60 is such a wonderful place for people from all over the state to come to. I think this is a very worthwhile request.
The arts are a very important part of our quality of life. There's no doubt about it.
And Mr. Senator, I'm not sure if with your previous bill, but you and I have been working on this together. I think I mentioned at the outset, I don't know if you were in the room or not.
No.
But you might have been outside, but I did mention at the outset that this is an effort on the part of both of us jointly.
Okay. Thank you all very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you very much.
Your people are here now?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be quick?
We'll be quick.
All right. Senator Larson, since you got two in a row, we'll take Senator Fischbach. Senator Fischbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2366 is a bonding request for City of Cold Spring for some downtown riverfront redevelopment, and I certainly do appreciate the committee moving things around so that the folks could be here to explain this to you. But I think this is a wonderful opportunity for the City of Cold Spring. Cold Spring Granite has been on that site for ever.
99 years.
And this is some beautiful riverfront property that they've now moved to the other side of town and are looking at having this open to the city to redevelop and to create a trailhead for the Ricori Trail. I can't remember if it was in this committee or another committee. We heard the Ricori Trail request the other day. But it is a huge opportunity for the region when this land has come open. And I do have with me Mike Kathman from Cold Spring City Council and Sharon Jensen from Cold Spring Granite, and I'm sure they would like to say it.
Welcome to the committee. Whoever wants to go first, go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Jensen. Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Sharon Jensen. I am a Cold Spring native and have been with Cold Spring Granite Company for the past 19 years. I am currently the Community Relations Director for the company. Cold Spring Granite was founded by my grandfather 109 years ago. 99 years ago, the company relocated its manufacturing facilities from Rockville, Minnesota, 6 miles west of Cold Spring, and a location on the Sauk River formerly occupied by a burned-out flour mill. While the city was looking to bring a new business into town, the company needed a new location and thus began a long-term working relationship. The company's growth and success have undoubtedly been the result of the dedication and hard work consistently shown by our fine employees, most of whom are residents of this immediate area. The company's site of almost 30 acres has served us well for 99 years. Now we have the opportunity to work with the city to redefine the formerly industrial site to an area that will benefit the citizens of Cold Spring and the surrounding area and bring others to a beautiful location in central Minnesota. The company is collaborating with the city in design and development and will make a donation of parkland on this site. One portion of the donation includes nearly 3 acres of land on the Sauk River adjacent to the existing Frogtown Park. The other parcel of land is located upstream from the dam in the heart of the development. The River Plaza Park will provide exceptional access to the river and a great view of the state park across the river. Included in the project is the creation of features at River Plaza Park and the riverbank immediately below the dam. An important element of the redevelopment is the creation of the new walking trail along the river. The vision calls for the trail to begin at Frogtown Park and form a connection to the Lions Park south of Highway 23. Included in the cost of the project is providing the city with an easement along the river from Frogtown Park to the River Plaza Park. The project includes $250,000 for the construction of the boardwalk from Main Street to River Plaza Park. With enhanced docking included in this proposal at Lions Park, the riverfront promenade, and the development of a canoe portage and pedestrian and bike trails, the chain of lakes will hold many opportunities for the citizens of the Ricori area and the many visitors we will all anticipate in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention to the committee, there is a packet, and as Ms. Jensen was talking, I thought maybe the map would be helpful.
This is the one we saw when we were at the bonding committee with you're getting out of the old building and moving to a new one, right?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't remember if you were there or not. You left that much of an impression on me. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I'm really worried that you forgot that I was there because, your memory is normally better than mine. Could be that old-timer's disease setting in over there.
But,
anyway.
Mr. Chair, it is the one right along 23, just you as you're coming into Cold Spring, right over to the right. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm reminding anyone else on the committee that forgot.
The Frog Town thing I don't remember much, but I thought that was
you
the
didn't
same
see
fall,
that.
But.
No, Mr. Chair, you didn't see that. It's up the river. If you look at it's up the river a bit. You might... Okay. You can see where the trail goes. But okay. You didn't see that... But we could have fooled you and told you you did. Yeah,
you didn't see me there, so you probably wouldn't. You probably would have shown me if you had. But anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry,
Mr. Chair and members. My name is Michael Kathman. I'm a resident of Cold Spring, and I've served on the Planning Commission, City Council, Mayor for 27 years, on and off. The Cold Spring is part of a larger community that encompasses the Ricori School District. It's made up of multiple townships in the cities of Richmond, Rockville, and Cold Spring. These cities and townships have worked together for a long time now. Some of the results of that cooperation are we share a waste treatment facility with the city of Rockville. We provide police services for the township and for the city of Richmond. We do a lot of joint purchasing. We look at how we can, as we purchase things, how we can provide backup for each other. So there's a long history in these communities of working together. The Ricori Trail that you referred to earlier is just another one of those types of things that we're working on. We've worked closely with the Granite Company. I've worked with them now for 27 years. They've been a very, very good neighbor. We really appreciate the way in which they've gone about this particular project. We've been told that this is the largest redevelopment project in outstate Minnesota, 30 acres in a downtown area. We have been working with them. We have provided some TIF financing. Our Economic Development Authority has recommended that we approve more. We're, in fact, meeting Thursday with the Granite Company to work out some of the details on this. So we're working with them, I think, very well. Where we're running into some difficulties is a lot of what we would like to see are amenities that really service the whole area. And it's just not possible for the city and the Granite Company to pay for all of these. So what we're looking for is assistance from you to provide the types of amenities that will draw tourists to the area that provide, you talked about the dock. The dock is used by people from all over the area, not just the residents of Cold Spring. So what we're really looking for, as I said, is assistance. We'll be investing millions of dollars, both the city and the Granite Company. But there's just we have this unbelievable opportunity. I don't know if many of you have ever been to Naperville, Illinois, or maybe San Antonio to see what you can really do when you can open up a riverfront. And there are very few opportunities that you have where you can do this. And we'd really like to do it right, both for our community and for the whole area. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions, we'll be happy to try to answer them. You do have a complete detail of everything that we're asking for in the packet that you were given.
Very well done, too. Thank you very much. Any questions or comments from the committee? Okay. Senator Fischbach, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your thank time. You. Thank you. Senator Larson. Thank you for being patient, Senator Larson.
No problem, Mr. Chair. I'd like to start with Senate File 730.
Okay.
It's getting set up here and appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You should have a handout. I think it's being handed out right now, which is a description of what we're trying to accomplish with Senate File 730, which is a request for $4.6 million in state bonding for the Richfield Parkway, which is not just about the city of Richfield. It is very regional and I would argue statewide in its impact. Members, if you think back to the decision made in the mid to late 90s about keeping the airport in its current location, that meant a development of a new runway or a new runway at MSP called the North-South Runway. Without walking through all of that history, if you look at the first photo right here that is in your handout, you can see how close the new North-South Runway is to residents that live in the city of Richfield. Now, back in 2000, the legislature, recognizing that the placement of this runway this close to a residential community was harmful, legislation was passed that helped to purchase properties in this quadrant here. And that has since resulted in a commercial development of there's a Target and a Home Depot and a number of other related retail establishments. Mr. Chair and members, what this does, the Parkway does, is it allows for us to connect the communities of South Minneapolis not only with the ability to with a Parkway for vehicle traffic, but in addition to that, pedestrian and bike traffic. What makes this regional, especially as it relates to the bike and pedestrian traffic, is the Cedar Avenue bike corridor runs, and you'll see with the purple line, from South Minneapolis just to the south of Lake Nokomis, and you'd also see the other colored lines line up to other bike and pedestrian paths. That makes a connection that gets folks all the way to Eagan with the completion of the old Cedar Avenue Bridge. And there is a transit and bike trail connectivity that is very regional in its basis. What I'm asking for revenue here today, or bonding funds here today for members, is very, very much important to the city that I represent. Given the fact that the state has benefited a great deal by having this new runway at MSP and has saved the taxpayers an enormous amount of money by not relocating the entire airport, we want to try to make some improvements in this area so that we can have the community that's adjacent to the new runway to be livable. And you can see that part of what will happen with this parkway is it will allow us to develop some housing to buffer the most impacted areas of the new runway with housing that can sustain what is referred to as low-frequency noise. And without getting into all that, I know that Senator Dibble knows exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about low-frequency noise, given that he has communities that are also very much affected by this noise.
Is that like when you pull up to a stop sign and they're playing that music alongside you and all of a sudden your car starts jumping up?
That is, yeah. Mr. Chairman, that is exactly what it is.
Starts to dance with the car next to you?
Yeah. That's right. And Mr. Chair, if it happens that there's a car in between you and the car with the loud music, you still feel the impact. It's not a noise that's easily insulated against. And so what we've been working on and will for a long time is trying to create a buffer within the city of Richfield that is parallel to that new runway. The folks that live along this corridor are incredibly impacted by this new runway. This new runway has been, something that has saved the state money in the long run, and we're just trying to make sure that it's livable and compatible with the residents. I want to introduce testifiers today, Mike Eastling, who is the Director of Public Works, and we also have with us Steve Devich, the City Manager of Richfield, who is here to answer questions. But with that, Mr. Eastling, if you'd like to provide some description.
Before you start, Senator Dibble, did you want to make a comment?
Mr. Chair, I was going to say about this low-frequency noise. My constituents have some impact, but the effect on Richfield is much more pronounced. What's so vexing about it is that, unlike, the treatments that we do for homes for the kind of noise that we're familiar with from airplanes going overhead, the low-frequency noise does is it travels to the ground. And so it's really hard to do much about it. They did a big study, found out problem impacts people, kind of affects, you know, kind of your body, not your ears as much, but you feel it in your body like you were talking about. There's very little to be done about it. It's
kind of like when they blast that hibbing pack at 11 o'clock every Wednesday, my house shakes, you know. Anyway, go ahead, Mr. Eastling. Please say your name for the record.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present this. I'm Mike Eastling. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Richfield. I would like to take some time to just make sure that there's a kind of a regional context to the project that we have right here, do that, and explain briefly a few of the benefits. I think, first of all, just to make sure clear on the project, in the darker blue line here is actually the Richfield Parkway that the city is requesting funding for. And right here, this interchange that's located right here was reconstructed with the new north-south runway. It was part of the north-south runway improvements. And there was a frontage road that served as the commercial access to this part of the city. This new interchange severed that frontage road and made it no longer workable for the narrow commercial corridor. Coupled with that is that with the new runway that was in place here, the single-family homes especially that were in this area were no longer compatible with this new regional use. And in addition, in this area that's in blue has been, the single-family homes have been removed and a commercial area has been brought in. What has not happened, however, and I should also point out that there is a new intersection that was placed in here that at the expense of the city and the developer in order to provide a new access into the commercial area in here. What has not happened yet, though, is this area in pink that is now still has single-family homes and is immediately adjacent to a Target and Home Depot, a truly incompatible use next to that kind of use. We're trying to find a way, this is where the economic development component comes in, try to find a way to redevelop this area. But in order to do that, a replacement to that commercial access that was formerly provided by that frontage road will be provided by the new Richfield Parkway. And this provides access then from the city of Minneapolis down across the bridge and down to Richfield, and eventually, and I'll show on the other page how that hooks up with the city of Bloomington. There is a pretty robust bicycle system down along the river, but the airport kind of severs any of that connection as you proceed west from the river. The first opportunity that you have, say, to cross the crosstown is at Bloomington Avenue. So we're saying that this is a parkway. It's really a bikeway attached to it. There's a street need there, but there's a heavy bikeway need that would connect to the Chain of Lakes bikeway system and come across here. The access down here that Senator Lincheski is trying to find funding for, the Cedar Avenue bike bridge, getting some final funding for that. That bridge is located here, and there is a bikeway system then that connects south of the river. This is both a commuter and a recreational bikeway pathway that's seeking a location and a route through Richfield, and we're proposing it on this route. I should also maybe go back.
So this right here is the north-south runway, right? Is that correct?
Yeah. For orientation on the map, we see a little corner, yeah. The other map. Yeah. You see this part of the runway. This is the new north-south runway.
Yeah.
This is where there was a golf course and single-family homes formerly.
Okay.
In this area. And I maybe as long as I have this up, I should point out also the transit facilities. This new intersection that the city put in is a transit-oriented development type of intersection, particularly attuned to bus traffic. But there's the LRT system that comes from the Mall of America and finds its way through this area. And there is bus routes connecting our 66th Street to this LRT. There is also the Dakota County BRT system that comes up Cedar Avenue at this location, and 66th Street is an important access point for that BRT. So the picture I'm trying to paint is that there's several regional, statewide kinds of facilities that kind of pinch right into this location. And I'm just going to briefly go over the benefits from a state perspective and regional significance that once the legislature decided to expand the runway, it caused the land use conflicts in the immediate area. There's the new interchange at 66th and Trunk Highway 77, also forced its way into the city. This new Richfield Parkway connects both Minneapolis and Richfield Parkway amenities, and it acts as a noise buffer in response to the new north-south runway. It promotes a healthy lifestyle through the as a critical link from the Cedar Avenue bike corridor pedestrian path through, up to Minneapolis, encourages new transit, replaces the frontage road that was lost in order to get the new bridge in. I would like to just point out one other element of this. The right thing to do in this area from a land use perspective is make this commercial. This does generate significantly more traffic than what has been there historically. What is shown on this map is the crossing, the Bloomington Avenue that comes today is a residential street, 2,000 cars a day. With this commercial corridor attracting more traffic, it's now at 5,000. In order to protect this neighborhood from that level of traffic, the idea is to bring the traffic that's coming across this bridge that really has that commercial destination, allow them to get to the commercial access rather than come down through the single family neighborhood here.
Say, Mr. Eastling, I gotta tell you, I gotta compliment you on not bringing one of those little red laser pens and going like this and trying to make us figure out where in the hell the circle is on it. Right. I like the pointer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I'm the old fashioned, I guess.
Okay, no, I like it.
Well, and I think that intersection that the city put in was to the tune of $4.5 million with right of way and things. So there was a significant local financial input into these projects already. So maybe with that I can close and stand for questions.
So is the request of 4.6 here? Is that will that finish the project, or is there more to be put in by the city, or? Go ahead, Mr. Devich.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Devich, and I am the city manager for the city of Richfield. With respect to the $4.6 million, that aids us in putting together the parkway. The city of Richfield, of course, will have to put that last piece of development, the pink shaded area. That's going to have to be more of a multifamily housing that can attenuate low frequency sound, and that's probably an extra 10-12% cost to put in and for someone to purchase. So the city's going to have some significant investment in that redevelopment also. But really the linchpin of this is having that parkway in to have the connection so that what we have already established doesn't keep on drawing folks through the neighborhoods that are left to be protected has that first leg of connection up to Minneapolis. So it does really complete the top the first leg of our project, except that we'll have to then put the housing piece in.
So how easy or difficult is it to convince people to move into those homes?
Well,
I realize that's kind of hypothetical, but
yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You know, as of right now, tomorrow night we have two developers who are coming to the Richfield Housing and Redevelopment Authority with a couple of ideas of some kinds of housing that they could put in there. If it's done right, and if you can attenuate that noise element, I think it can be very successful. The idea is that, and you know, you had a great analogy, Mr. Chair, and that is the low frequency noise, that boom, boom, boom kind of thing you hear from the car next door. It's kind of a wood frame structure. It's kind of like a hollow body wooden guitar. And when it resonates sound, and that's what, you know, wood frame structures do. So if we're going to build these other housing units out of concrete, and they'll have fewer windows, and the doors will be oriented, you know, differently, so you won't have a lot of that kind of access towards the runway, it can be a comfortable place to live, even in view of the kind of sound that you would be sort of bombarded with.
Would these be townhouses, just regular single-family homes? What would they be?
You know, they probably wouldn't be single-family homes. They would probably be some sort of configuration of a townhouse or some kind of a project like that. That is something that will, you know, that'll have to be seen yet. We'll probably get some first ideas of that tomorrow night. But that's what we see so far, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, I was just going to point out, if you've been down to see the Bloomington development that's over from where the mall is, that the light rail transit comes through, they're developing, you know, all kinds of housing, you know, multifamily housing, these glass apartment buildings and condos and the like, and it's pretty spectacular. That new construction actually blocks out all, and it's pretty much, you know, under the flight path of the new north-south runway, a little bit over. But you're inside those, and you're watching these planes take off, and you don't hear a thing. You don't feel a thing. It's pretty incredible with the new materials. Problem is, of course, that all this housing around the airport was built either pre or post World War II, and you know the amount of the volume of traffic that's increased overhead, you know, is comparable to another large airport being built in the area, and so these homes just aren't built to handle all of that noise. So the new construction can handle it. The old stuff has a heck of a time.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the time today. And I think it just to sum up would say that when this sort of demonstrates that when we make a major improvement, such as a new runway at North-South, the new North-South runway at that location, and we move the airport that much closer to neighborhoods, that the impact actually continues on far beyond the boundary of the airport. We clearly see that with this, and so I appreciate your consideration today and your time. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Dibble.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm just a little bit unclear, Senator Larson. Which part of this, if this were to succeed, part of it would be used for the bicycle facility as well?
There is, and maybe Mr. Eastling can give us a better idea of how the lanes work, but there will be a pedestrian bicycle component in addition to the vehicle component.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the city council very carefully chose the word parkway when were labeling this. This is to have a significant park element because of the residential property along its boundary. It's also close to the adjacent Roosevelt Park. They wanted to extend that park feature down this corridor with not only on-street biking but off-street biking and pedestrian system that will be accommodated down this corridor. There is certainly more of an emphasis and concern for transit, pedestrian, bikeway. There needs to be also for the car, but the distinguishing elements of these are all have to do with the parkway and the bikeway.
Senator Dibble.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to confirm I enthusiastically support this. And, of course, bikes go both ways, so I'm looking forward to access down to the river areas from my neighborhoods. But I just want to be sure that you're in conversation with our Minneapolis Park Board planners so they know that changes are afoot. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. That absolutely is occurring on a regional basis.
Great.
So that there's coordination throughout this. And, of course, Mr. Chair, I'd also want to make sure that I pointed out to you that this area here is where I started my football career.
And where do you
also
live?
Ended it, Mr. Chair.
and do you live on that map anywhere? Is your house on that map anywhere?
No, my house is, if you looked at the end of the runway, yeah. No, I live right, let's see, right over here.
So do you have one of those houses that hear the noise or don't hear the noise?
Well, Mr. Chair, if you've ever been on an airplane that uses the crosswind runway, known as the 422, when that takes off, if you're on the nonstop to Europe or to Tokyo, then I hear you real loud and clear.
Okay, well, you haven't heard me yet, so
I've come running up the stairs late at night, different times, wondering how many people had just stormed into my house, and it's a 747. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Gentlemen. Appreciate it. Okay, you have one more, Senator Larson.
Yes, thank you very much, and appreciate the committee's patience with us here from Richfield. This is another project that is, again, has statewide significance, but it's located in the city of Richfield. I'm sure many or all of you have heard the story over the years about a famous Minnesotan that lived with us for many, many years and was one of the true war heroes of World War II. And that was Charles Chuck Lindbergh, who was the last living first flag raiser of the first flag that was raised upon Iwo Jima on February 23rd, 1945. And Mr. Lindbergh, following the war, was a Richfield resident, I believe, ever since he came back from the war. In fact, I went to grade school and up through high school with his daughter. In fact, remember as a kid at Sheridan Elementary School, having this person who was, we were told, was a war hero come and tell us about this flag raising. And when you're in the sixth grade, you know, your history isn't all that great. But I, as I look back on that, it's amazing to me the history lesson that I received when I was, I think, in the sixth grade from somebody who was actually at that mountaintop and raised that flag. And it was a fascinating story then, and unfortunately, we lost Chuck Lindbergh a year ago, 2 days before his 87th birthday, in fact, less than a year ago. And that's the backdrop for what is being proposed here. In fact, not even is well into production in terms of construction, and that is a all-veterans memorial to be constructed in the city of Richfield at Veterans Memorial Park, with the feature being the raising of the first flag and a monument to the flag raisers, with the spotlight being on Chuck Lindbergh and a bronze statue of him that, Mr. Chair, would be coming out of a piece of taconite that was mined in Eveleth, Minnesota. In fact, I'm going to introduce Travis Gorshi, who was there and can verify it came right out of the mine, because he was there when it was brought out. And we appreciate the incredible amount of support we've seen from people all over Minnesota, including a lot of corporate support all across the state, including the Eveleth, I believe it was the Eveleth Mine Company. We are here to ask for $200,000 in bonding money to supplement the incredible fundraising that's been occurring. This is a memorial that will honor all veterans in Minnesota and give the opportunity for all veterans to be honored with their names to be inscribed in tablets that will be described to you. But again, the center of the memorial will focus on Minnesota's war hero, Chuck Lindbergh, and the story of that first flag raising. And with that, I'm going to introduce Jim Topitzhofer, who is the Director of Parks and Recreation for the City of Richfield, and then Travis Gorshi, who is the designer of the was a personal friend of Mr. Lindbergh's, will also give us some perspective.
Did you get your picture taken with him when he was at the Capitol a couple of years ago?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I did have the chance to do that, and that was pretty special.
Because I got one, too.
And I also, that's great. And he was an incredible guy, and they're an incredible family. He also was just a couple of months before his death at the groundbreaking for the memorial. Again, it's the construction has begun. Essentially, in fact, Mr. Chair, someday I should drive you out there, because you'll see that 13-ton piece of taconite from Eveleth that's sitting in Memorial Park, just waiting for this incredible memorial to construct around it. Mr. Topitzhofer.
Go ahead, Mr. Topitzhofer.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. On behalf of the City of Richfield, I'm grateful to present the Honoring All Veterans Memorial. This project was developed through the efforts of the Richfield Arts Commission, and a talented artist sitting on my right, Travis Gorshi, who had the passion to honor the memory of United States military veterans from all military branches, and the vision to provide a place for all people all over the state of Minnesota to reflect and thank those who have served. A group of dedicated volunteers has been formed, has formed a nonprofit organization for the purpose of raising funds to build this memorial in Veterans Memorial Park, which is on Portland Avenue, just south of Crosstown. This group also oversees the construction of the monument and would ultimately donate the finished product to the City of Richfield. The city would then take on the responsibility of taking care of it so that it can be enjoyed by all for years to come. The group has worked hard over a year's time now and has raised $140,000 on its own. The total project cost is over $700,000, with most of the funding coming from donations in return for engraving sponsorships. The monument is adorned with many granite tablets that will carry the engraved names of veterans. giving friends and relatives the opportunity to honor a special veteran. The names of all veterans are welcome on this memorial, active or retired, wartime or peacetime, full service or reserves, deceased or living, and regardless of residency. So far, we've collected over 240 names that will be put on these, engraved on these tablets. And they range from Civil War veterans all the way to present time. The memorial has the capacity to receive thousands more. As mentioned, the construction of this monument is well underway. Our first milestone was selecting a large rock to mount the centerpiece, the bronze sculpture on. And we found a 13-ton taconite rock, which was just the perfect size and shape from the Cleveland Cliffs mine in Eveleth, Minnesota. And that achieved our goal of incorporating the rich heritage of Minnesota's mining industry into the monument. We've contracted an artist to complete the bronze statue of Chuck Lindbergh. That takes a year to do, and it's very tedious. They actually have to go through a five-mold process, reversing the mold, so forth, to end with the finished product of a bronze hollow statue. It's similar to, the artist describes it like an Easter bunny egg, a kind of a hollow thing. That's the finished product. We're confident that we'll have that centerpiece done with the statue completed on time before the unveiling this July. Just two points that I'd like to emphasize today to the committee, and that would be that we view this project very much as a regional project, not a city project, and let me explain why. I mentioned that we've already collected 240 names to be placed on this monument and granite tablets to be made part of the monument. The majority of those names come from people outside of Richfield, metro area and outstate, all over the state. And I think that really demonstrates the notoriety of Chuck Lindbergh. It also demonstrates the need for us to have an opportunity to have a place to gather to display the names of any veteran as a way to show our appreciation. We anticipate the percentage of non-Richfield names to increase as the construction of the memorial continues. The second point is we believe that this project, design and concept, sells itself, and we need your help to get it done. We are asking help from the state of Minnesota to contribute $200,000 to jumpstart the completion of a larger portion of this monument so we can promote the sale of additional engravings as a way to sustain the source of funds needed to get the job done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Topitzoffer.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Travis Gorshi, member of the Richfield Fine Arts Commission, designer and founder of this project.
Mr. Gorshi, are you related to the Chisholm Gorshis?
Yes, I am. That is my. That's where I'm from, born and raised. So
I kind of thought
my father. So that's a. Is that where you're from?
Yes.
Oh,
your wonderful. Dad was Paul.
Yep.
Okay.
Are we picking up steam, Mr. Chair?
Senator Larson, I was just thinking. We're trying to build one of these in Virginia too, and it's amazing how difficult it is to build war memorials to our fallen. I mean, we should just be able to put a big pot of money out there and just put them up anywhere we want to. That's kind of
it'd be wonderful. I knew when I brought the project up and approached Mr. Lindbergh in February of 2005. So to look back 3 years ago is when I came up with the idea, and 3 years later I'm at the state capitol asking for money. It's pretty exciting. He became a very good friend to myself and my family. I still presently talk to his widow Vi on a regular basis, and try to keep in touch with his children. So it's a great story. What really enthused me about Chuck was he, a little bit on his service. He was in the United States Marine Corps. He did three amphibious landings, starting with November of 42 at Guadalcanal, November 43 at Bougainville. He came home in March of 44 for leave and then thought he was done when he was reassigned to go take on Iwo Jima and was on that landing in February of 45. When he went, the picture's up here. This is the top picture in the upper left-hand corner is the as they start to climb Mount Suribachi. He's actually taking point on the lead as they're bringing up the flag. Mr. Lindbergh there with the flamethrower. In the middle here, that is Mr. Lindbergh at the front. When they actually reached the summit, they found a water pole or a water pipe that had a hole in it, a bullet hole that they tied the flag to. Hmm. And that's him in the foreground. And on the far right with the flag up, that's him standing up behind right here. Shortly after that, they received absolutely no resistance as they climbed. But as soon as they got to the top, they received a lot of resistance and dispersed. That flag was the first flag to be raised on Japanese soil in World War II. 6 days later, Mr. Lindbergh was shot in the arm. He went to a hospital in Guam where a week later, somebody came to him and said, do you want to see a picture of the flag going up on Iwo Jima? And lo and behold, he goes, this ain't the first flag. And it was the Rosenthal picture. He was called a liar for many years. He spent his lifetime educating and re-educating and telling the story of the first flag. Not for himself, but just for the recognition of the other Marines that went up and raised that first flag. He said it was the proudest day. It was the day that they all recognized that first flag was when all the ship's horns blew. If any of you have seen Flag of Our Fathers, he's depicted in that in about six different scenes. It's the one that carried a lot of weight, but the story's been covered up. It's probably been about 10, 12 years now that it's been acknowledged and starting to come out in the recognition. So this memorial and the steam of it is to continue raising, continue educating people of the first flag. He was an electrician at the local 292 of the IBEW. Retired there, they have been a gigantic backer of the memorial or local building trades. Let's see, I also want to say, Mr. Lindbergh was always available to anybody that wanted to come meet him. It took me 4 years to get enough to go approach him and just to want to meet him. And I found out now that he received on average 30 items from around the United States and the world on a weekly basis for people to sign books, pictures, and all that. And he never once turned anything down. He did up to 180 speaking engagements on a regular basis around to schools and military organizations on a 30-minute presentation, which he stopped doing about a year ago due to his health. As Ms. Senator Larson stated, June of last year, I lost a great friend with his passing. Two facts about that funeral. It was the first military funeral I ever went to. The state patrol counted over 300 vehicles in his procession. His motorcade represented 12 of the local law enforcement that were there. When you left the chapel at Fort Snelling, the last car leaving there, the first car was pulling into the Fort Snelling Cemetery. So they had blocked off all that traffic for it. Also, it was the number one story on the worldwide internet for 2 days after his passing. There was publications worldwide, and even the country of Japan did a very, very nice story on his passing. And that Vi still to this day has a chuckle over that, thinking, boy, my husband took over their land, and then they write a story about him when he passes. Just kind of goes to show what type of person he was and the importance that he carried. A couple of things I'll be wrapped up. I just want to go over the design a little bit because it started off, we wanted to bring more public art into the city of Richfield. It's a 60-foot in diameter base with six 15-foot high concrete and granite columns that takes into consideration the Native American belief of the circle of life and its four directions. The columns represent the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Merchant Marine, and Coast Guard, the six recognized veteran branches. They bend inwards, pointing towards the American flag, which stands for our armed services, bend but never break. They'll have the emblem of each branch on the front and then the hymn of each one in the back. This was Chuck's sculpture here with the Peace Attack Night. This will also take notice and tell the story of the first flag raising and acknowledgement of the five other Marines that raised that flag. Outside, on the east and west, Actually, between the two columns, excuse me, is a glass prism, about a 2-foot piece of glass. If you were to take it and cut it in a diamond shape facing inwards and flat, drill a hole and cut it, put a crystal in, and in theory, as the sun rises and sets, it'll shoot a spectrum of light across the memorial as a full day honoring to our veterans. So it should be the first interactive memorial in the United States. And then outside of that is where there'll be five granite tablets on the east and west. They each hold 100 names, so that'll be 1,000 names. It's designed to continue building out as we get more names, and it'll extend out 4 west, 6 east, 3, 7, 2, 8. So by the time it's completed, when you're coming in from a westbound landing into the airport, if you look down to Richfield, you'll see a lighted teardrop for tears of joy and tears of sorrow for our veterans. So you'll have a gigantic teardrop. So there's a big artistic theory and presentation that goes along with the memorial.
That's neat. That's really neat. Is he related to the Spirit of St. Louis?
No, sir. Mr. Lindbergh doesn't have an H at the end of his name. That's why if you ever see his signatures or if you ever signed anything, he usually signed Chuck versus Charles, because just to cut down.
Okay. Okay. Any questions of the committee? Okay. Any further comments?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you. Are we done?
Yep.
Wednesday at 3?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.